Hello, everyone. Welcome. I'm Carrie L., and this is Carrie L.'s Heartlink Show. And as I connect to as many hearts as possible, we are creating more freedom and light, one interview at a time. So my programs will bring you insights into the Great Awakening that is underway on planet Earth as we approach 2012. I'll be keeping you abreast of the latest tools available for anchoring a greater and healthier reality into your life. I'll be interviewing cutting-edge experts in the metaphysical, scientific, paranormal, and spiritual. And today's guest is Dr. Brooks Agnew, who is a published PhD physicist with decades of research in spectrometry, I'm not sure I'm saying that right, of creation. And he's going to be on in a moment, but first, I would like to just give you some special blessing of the day from the Gayatri Prayer. Let us focus on that effulgent light from which the whole universe is projected. May this inner sun enlighten our minds and hearts, and may we awaken as that light. So good things are coming your way, and just want to also announce my website is www.heartlinkinstitute.com, and we're having some exciting things happening. We're going to have a special workshop next month in March, so check that out. And if you're in the Oceanside, California area, please join us. Also, check out my Crop Circle cards, The Living Oracle. And now, without further ado, let's go to Brooks Agnew. Welcome, Brooks.
Oh, thank you so much. It's so nice to be here.
Well, you are a PhD doctor, and you have done some very special work as a writer with a partnership with E.J. Clarke, and she sounds very fascinating. She is a archaeologist, apparently. And
she was a medical professional in Middle Tennessee, and in those days that was kind of grandfathered in. You didn't have to have a degree. You just worked as an anesthetist and worked your way up. So naturally she made a lot more money than the normal working women in Middle Tennessee, and she was able to afford to feed her passion, which was archaeology. So she traveled all over the world and got all kinds of information. And actually, her claim to fame was discovering that National Geographic had published a picture upside down.
Oh, isn't that something? And so you've done some special work with her. And what's the name of your book?
The series is called The Ark of Millions of Years, like Noah's Ark. And the first book is subtitled Further Light and Discoveries on the Creation of the Earth. The second one is called 2012 and the Harvest of the End Times. And the third one is called Unlocking the Secret.
And you also have your own radio show on BBS. And why don't you tell us about that and how people can find out more about you? What's your website?
Oh, sure. It's X Squared Radio, and you can either Google that or go to x2-radio.com. We do scientific talk radio primarily, Sunday nights from 8 to 11 Eastern. We talk to astronomers and biologists and physicists, and we talk about the mysteries of the universe and the Earth.
Mm-hmm. It's a fascinating radio show. I get mesmerized, but you go right into some really technological information, and you are so well versed in that information. And did I say that right? Spectrometry.
Yeah, spectrometry. That's pretty good. Better than most people can say it. I have a hard time sometimes.
And I love the fact that you've written this book, The Ark of a Million Years. And it is profound. And in reading it, I came to some understanding about how evolution can be reconciled with the creation theory.
Want to explain
what you talk about in your book?
Yeah, you know, I grew up and learned evolution along with everyone else, and then every Sunday I got creation along with everyone else, and I had a hard time reconciling it. And as I became a scientist and getting my technical training, I did run across a lot of agnostics and people that didn't believe in God, because they just couldn't see how religion and science could exist together. But what I found as I did my research and started looking at both religion and science with an open mind is they do fit together. And at one time, they did fit together perfectly. But I guess to keep from going to war and fighting all the time, they agreed to be separate. And I think that was the downfall of both of them.
Mm. So how, in what way are they similar? And I guess explain how that works.
Sure. Well, evolution sort of came to be because a naturalist whose name was Darwin discovered in the Galapagos that complex life adapted to its environment. And this was brought about by what he claimed were random changes or random mutations in DNA that gave an organism unusual abilities to survive in certain environments. Well, from this, the rest of the world extrapolated the theory of evolution, that somehow we crawled forth from a primordial ooze and we adapted to our environment, continuing until we became a more complex, more intelligent being, and thus man was born. But as you study science, what you realize is that although adaptation of DNA is possible, the actual first proteins had to be made from DNA, from genes. And DNA is an engineered molecule. It could not have evolved. So what we see is a system that was designed to evolve, but it was designed nonetheless.
Okay.
Well, that makes it interesting because that means one has to think about who the designer was and how it is that sentient beings, intelligent beings who can control their environment, can change how they evolve. The fact is that human beings are continuously evolving. And we do that because we're changing our environment, either consciously or unconsciously. Well, the interesting thing is, when the human genome was researched out, 5 years ago, a series of papers were released that showed that human beings don't have hundreds of thousands of genes as expected. They only have about 25,000 genes. However, we have about 150,000 proteins that make up the human body. That means that genes can choose. They have a broad range of proteins that they can make. And that choice is made up based on the organism's environment, whether they're in a heavy stressful environment or a very easy environment, a high protein or a high sugar environment, or an environment that's controlled by the conscious being themselves. So now what you have is you've got the consciousness of the human being influencing the proteins the genes can make. Now you have a being that is consciously evolving. And that makes a very exciting prospect for science.
Hmm. So the Earth is alive. And it is functioning somewhat like the way you've explained it. It came through a black hole from the cosmic sea. I like that.
Yeah, when Noah arrived, he actually told his people and told the people that he came across as he traveled around the world that he had sailed his ark of a million years, or ark of millions of years, across a cosmic sea. And what we find when we look at the Earth is that there are actually two different phases of matter that make up the Earth. We have a higher vibrational matter and we have a lower vibrational matter. And the reason we say that the Earth is alive, that's not too unlike what we are. We are, of course, the calcium and iron and different proteins that make up our physical body. And we're also that person that stares back at us in the mirror each morning. So we are higher vibrational matter, which is the spirit, and we're lower vibrational matter, which is the 3D body that we occupy. So it's not a real big stretch to think that the Earth itself is higher vibrational matter, which came from deep space through a black hole, and it occupies the same place in space as this temporal matter, or 3D matter, which is the rocks and trees and water that makes up the physical part of the planet. The two create or exist as a living being called the Earth.
And so this is the ark that you're talking about.
Yes, the ark would have been not only Noah's ship upon a sea of a basically water planet that had never experienced any rain, but also the planet itself as it traveled through a massive spinning black hole from someplace near the center of our galaxy or even in another dimension to this spot and this orbit. And the process of blending the two planets took about 7 months for them to reach some kind of stable existence. And then Noah's Ark came to rest, and the occupants of the Ark spread out across the Earth and became part of the human society. And that genetic mix between the genetically advanced, say, Adam man from Adam to Noah, and man that was already on this Earth, and we are the genetic result of that blend.
So the two planets came together, I guess the spiritual and the lower whatever beings were on here.
Uh-huh. Well, actually, in the books, they're called Lower Adam. And in even the scriptures, in the Kabbalah, in the Zohar, in the Popol Vuh, many, many books written over many millennia, we have two different races of man on Earth. We have Lower Adam and we have Higher Adam.
And how do we know which one is which? I guess it's...
Well, the higher Adam would be the one that was created in the Garden of Eden, a genetically engineered perfect being, capable of living thousands of years, taller, more robust human, and then man that developed on the Earth naturally, somewhat a little bit more advanced than a Cro-Magnon man, proliferated across the Earth. And you can read about this even in Genesis. In Genesis, it talks about male and female being created and multiplying and replenishing the earth and tilling the ground. And then later in Genesis, it talks about Adam being put in the Garden of Eden. He exists for a period of time, could be 1,000 years, could be 10,000 years. And then Eve is created from his rib, genetically engineered, perfect match to him. And then they are allowed to proliferate. And that's where Noah's people came from.
So basically, are we to raise our frequency? Is that the point? And so that we can go to this higher Earth, would you say? Or what's our job as I guess humans having a, or spirit beings having a human experience?
That's a really good question. That the process of evolution of the being that is called human. We are beginning to stratify, but we're beginning to separate into spiritual beings and temporal beings. The spiritual being is one who can raise his vibrational frequency, can become aware of other life forms in the universe, say orbs or spirits, if you will, or higher guides, They become very benevolent, very loving. They learn to love themselves, love their neighbor, and, of course, love the God nature within them. And then you have the other being that cannot survive in the light. They're dark-hearted. They're violent. They're greedy. They're short-sighted. They don't do good planning. What will happen is, over time, the two will become unaware of each other, because darkness cannot exist in the light, and the light cannot abide darkness.
I was just speaking about how, or someone else was telling me that they were witnessing such low frequencies in people, more and more. I guess these people that have, like you just explained, kind of a darkness in their heart, or maybe not even have a heart.
Well, they should be cautious about noticing them, because, you know, dwelling upon or judging others will also lower the frequency of the being that's doing the judging. So the idea or the point is to not worry about how you are loved. Only concentrate on how you love others. And what will happen is a natural process of ascension. And it may come in little baby steps, and it may come in giant steps. It depends upon the individual himself. But once those steps are made, the actual DNA of that person begins to change. And there is some scientific evidence to back that up. Let me give you an example. There was an experiment done with rats, and these are healthy rats. They were given a drug which caused them to develop diabetes. Now, they did not genetically have diabetes, but they were given a drug that gave them diabetes. When these rats were bred, their pups actually had diabetes. It means that the pups learned diabetes from their parents. So if it can work in reverse, it can also work in the forward direction. We can raise the vibrational level of our own bodies through this process of really eliminating judgment and fear from our lives. And what will happen is that genetic process will be passed on to our children. And I don't think there's anyone out there that can tell me they're not aware that the children that are being born today are extremely brilliant, and they are very independent, and they pick up on things so quickly. The race of man is changing before our eyes.
Mm. Wow. It's such an interesting contrast of these brilliant children and the dark side. But you're saying
there is a contrast, absolutely a contrast. And
is it almost like this has to happen in order for the brilliance and the highest frequency also to appear?
Well, yeah, and I think there's a lot more happening than that. You know, we look at the Earth now, there are more people alive on the Earth now than have ever lived on the Earth before. Well, even the proponents of reincarnation are saying, they're asking a serious question. Where are all these souls coming from? Mm. They're not from Earth. They come with much higher memories, much higher capabilities than the average person. This is really contributing to the population of the planet. Now, you have to think about the planet itself, too. Earth is about to go through this 2012 change. When we begin the age of Aquarius, Earth itself will be going through a change. The two Earths, the spirit Earth or the higher vibrational Earth and the temporal Earth or lower vibrational Earth, they're going to separate. And all the matter that resonates with that higher vibration is going to go with it. And all the matter that resonates with the lower vibration is going to go with that. And so literally they're going to become unaware of each other. Now, anciently, well, not so anciently, maybe 2,000 years ago, this was termed the rapture. And this is where I guess a lot of people have taken artistic license with this and said that all the good people are going to be lifted up in the clouds and the evil people are going to be left up. That's not really the case. What will happen is a stratification and a separation of all matter.
So our job, should we choose it, is to vibrate at this higher frequency and just focus on that.
Yes, yeah, focus and evolve and concentrate on love and not fear.
Okay. I think we have a caller. Is there a caller here? All right, maybe not. I will take calls in about 10 minutes at the bottom of the hour, just so people know that. So, okay, so you speak about the history of this planet in such terms that, well, it's just refreshing. And you talk about the Nephilim, and I thought that was an eye-opener, even though Zachariah Sitchin has spoken about that as well. So you want to share what that's about?
Okay. My understanding of the Nephilim is that they were a group of around 200 what are termed fallen angels. These are beings that did not originate on this planet. They originated somewhere else. They were of great age and great accomplishment, but somehow they fell out of favor with the higher rulers. We'll just call him God. Fell out of favor with God and fell into this dimension, and they made their way to Earth. Now, they were of immense experience and skill, and they brought that experience and skill to the Earth, but they did not have the best interest of the race of man in mind. And so they taught their art and their science to the people of Earth and attempted to really capture the entire Earth. And what happened was man was just a little bit too much for them to handle. Some of the races forbid their people to breed with the Nephilim, and so they kept themselves genetically pure. Others did breed with them, and the race of giants were born. Several different tribes of giants were born. Now, some of the giants were hybrids and were not fertile. Some of the giants were fertile. And some of those genes still exist in our genetics. Six toes, six fingers, multiple rows of teeth, giantism, that is immense height. All of these are leftover giantish traits. Now, when the two Earths came together during the flood of Noah, most or not all of the giants were wiped out, and the Nephilim left the planet. But they did return, because in Numbers chapter 13, which is well after the flood, sure enough, the Nephilim show back up and are up to their same old tricks. Excuse me. Their likenesses are even carved into the walls of Rosslyn Chapel so that they could keep the leaders of that day aware of who the Nephilim were and what they were about.
The descendants of the Nephilim, however, are very different, apparently. They're the good guys. Am I right about that?
They could be. Now, some of the giants actually tried to make a deal and survive the flood, and they talked with Enoch, who was Noah's grandson, spoke with him at length to try to survive the flood. But Enoch pretty much went to the higher beings and to God and came back and told the giants there was no way that at least the first generation of giants could survive. They were going to be destroyed. So some of the giants did work later, as they came back, as I said in Numbers chapter 13, for their redemption. There was a group of them, for instance, that worked with King David, a group of 600 of them, and they could run over 40 miles an hour. They could knock a horse to the ground with their bare hands. And they were David's guardians during the years that he was a refugee and running from assassins. Now, they spoke a very weird language, of course, with multiple rows of teeth and large sinus cavities. They said that their language sounded a lot like dolphins. They called it gibberish. And the tribe was known as the Gibberim.
Hmm. Gibberish, huh?
Hmm. Right. That's where the term came from.
And you speak about the Atlantis and the race of the Sea Kings and the nuclear warfare. Do you want to explain what's happened before on this planet?
Sure. About 25,000 years ago, in I believe it's a land called Harappus, there was a city that was excavated, and in the streets of the city, they noticed the carcasses of people laying in the streets as though they were running from something, and some of them were like father and mother and several kids all holding hands. I mean, they were killed where they stood, just laying in the street. But even though their bones were 25,000 years old, they were more radioactive than the bones of the dead at ground zero from Hiroshima.
Wow.
So there, it's evidence that thermonuclear war has happened on this planet before, and it goes back 25,000 years.
And so the wars, what did we learn from all that? I guess apparently nothing, apparently.
That's a really good observation, because there is a lot of what Michael Cremo calls forbidden archaeology on this planet, where bones and works of art and works of science and mechanics have been found in strata that isn't just 25,000 years old, it's 55 million years old.
Wow.
There is evidence that many, many advanced races once existed at one time or another on this planet and were destroyed or left.
So why aren't we being told this? I mean, why keep that information from us?
That's a really good question. I'm not really sure what the status quo, or what geologists, if that's what they call themselves, or archaeologists, if that's what they call themselves, what are they trying to maintain by hiding the fact that, and it is a fact because it's a direct observation and there's hard evidence to back it up, that ancient civilizations once lived on this planet. The only thing that I can think of is that perhaps all modern religions, and some of them go back to 600 BC, but not many more modern or more much older than that, it renders those religions ineffective. Now, I'm not saying the spirituality is ineffective. I'm saying that religion would be ineffective.
Mm, which is a very different thing.
Very different.
Oh, boy. Don't get me started on that one.
Okay, I won't. Because we only have 30 minutes.
So how do you see us? Where are we going? What's the good news, I guess, is?
Well, the good news is there are many institutions of suppression and, I would say, ancient subservience that are losing their grip. People are becoming aware. They are awakening. And it's largely because of radio programs like yours. They're out there, they're listening, and they're saying to themselves, I knew there was more to it than this. I knew that I was more than just somebody that's going to grow old and die and never exist again. And what's happening is people are beginning to take charge of their own progression. They're realizing that they don't have to be slaves. They don't have to be ignorant. The institutions of education. My friends and I sit around once in a while and we talk about great inventions. And for years and years, we pretty much irrefutably decided that the Gutenberg press was the greatest invention of all time.
Mm.
Because it put printed material in the hands of people so they could educate themselves instead of having to learn from priests or from the government.
Well, similar to the internet today.
I was going to say the same thing. In 1996, the internet pretty much became available to everyone. By 2000, high-speed internet was pretty much available to everyone. And now what's happening is institutional education is beginning to lose its grip because kids have access to the best library ever assembled. And they're learning at a rate much faster than teachers who are already, have yesterday's knowledge in their heads. They're learning at a rate much faster than can be imagined. And that will very soon be having its effect on our planet.
So you do see that the institutions that are feeding the negativity are collapsing at this point.
Well, I don't think they're collapsing at this point, but they're getting pretty close. Hang on one second.
Mm-hmm. And with that thought, we really are...
All right, I'm back. Sorry.
I think we're helping to add to the collapse in some way just by doing these shows.
Well, I don't know that it's a collapse. I don't want to say that because that implies that maybe things are going to get destabilized and get somewhat chaotic and anarchist. And that's not really what's happening. What's happening is it's going to break out of its current structure. It's going to evolve, and it's going to begin accelerating. And the race of man is going to become what it was destined to become from the very beginning, what we designed to become from the very beginning. The truth is, we are Source. We have God within each one of us. And the sooner we begin to let go of that denial and realize that our potential is absolutely unlimited, then we seize life with a fervor that not only gives us joy, but it lights up everyone around us, including our communities, our nations, and hopefully our whole planet. And war and fear become a thing of the past.
I like that point, that you, what you're saying is we really don't have to have something to collapse so much as where we focus is what is being fed and is going to grow more and more.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like one grid is replacing the other, and we won't even notice we just will go into this grid, and it won't matter whether the other grid is there or not.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting that you use that word, because one of the things that we're becoming aware of is that there is a geomagnetic lacing around our planet. It's tied into what's known as ley lines, mountains, tectonic plates or continental shelves. Even the core of the Earth itself is aligning the matter of the Earth into certain patterns. And people are now able to travel now as never before. And we can travel around the world in a couple days if we want to. And we can flash information around the world even faster than that. And what's happening is people are beginning to become aware of a connection between their bodies and the Earth. And the grid is beginning to connect to the human person, just the way it did anciently. Mm-hmm. Only this time, we have power distribution, we have information distribution, and we can even move ourselves around the planet.
Well, it's interesting. These times are challenges for many who have to deal with the financial situation on the planet and the old grid being changed, so to speak. You want to speak to that? I mean, there is an element going on here. What can we do about that?
Well, the most important thing to do is to stop focusing on the 3D. Now, what we discovered when we're working these formulas of intention is we found that people are concentrating on the money, and they're concentrating on their level of scarcity. And they're blaming their conditions on something else. And what they need to realize immediately is that they are 100% responsible for their current condition, whether it's their health or whether it's their economic condition. No one controls that but them. Once you come to that realization, the next thing to do is to figure out how you're going to climb out of scarcity. And what I have found is that most people concentrate on the money instead of what money can do for them. If they will concentrate on what they want to do with the money instead of the money, then the energy is completely different, and the universe can resonate with it instead of us trying to draw our own future thread through the universe and try to make it conform to what we think it should do. If we'll just concentrate on what it is we want to do instead of what it takes to get there, the universe will flow it to us. I promise it will happen. The laws of energy cannot keep it back.
So do you use some kind of spiritual discipline at all, meditation? Or?
I have researched meditation since I was 17 years old. I never really put much stock in it because it just didn't do anything for me until I learned how to do the Merkaba meditation. It's taught by a school called the Flower of Life. Once I learned to do that and I realized how quickly you could get into a meditative state, even while at work, then I started connecting with a more quiet mind. And that's really important to do because when you send an intention out in the universe, it creates a very real energy vibration. The universe sympathetically resonates with that and it pings something back to you. But if you're not quiet, you won't hear it. And it'll go right by you, and you won't know when to move.
Yes, I agree. Just sitting quietly, and as you say, really having that strong intention really has a lot of power. I know
and
we have a caller on the line. Caller, want to introduce yourself?
Hi,
where are you calling from, too?
My name is Joe. I'm calling from New York.
And Joe, you have a question for our guest, Dr.
I'm
Agnes?
I'm enjoying the show. Are you aware of a phenomena that had occurred to me about 10 years ago and occurs to me quite often, of being woken up a triple-digit number of times, like 4:44 in the morning, or seeing 111 all the time? It's been explained.
I'm not so familiar with the triple-digit. I don't think that's significant, but I do strongly believe that between 2 o'clock and 3 o'clock in the morning, people are regularly being awakened into a conscious state where they are highly intuitive.
Right.
And they actually get visions and answers.
Yes, I've had that happen to me also. I could actually see into the next dimension.
So
yeah.
Is what's the reason for that, Brooks? What would you say?
Well, I think there's in any biorhythm, there's a cycle. I mean, you go into the rest period, and then once the body has restored its ATP, all the mitochondria, all the protein is remade back into ATP, and it's stored in the mitochondria of the muscles and the tissues of the body. The body doesn't really need any more physical rest. So what is happening is these people that are getting into meditative states or into states of higher awareness, is their bodies are then kicking out of the 3D maintenance period, and they're going into an awake state of higher vibration without having to get up and go mow the lawn, so to speak.
I'm actually seeing.
And you're aware of these higher dimensions.
Right. I'm actually seeing almost the holographic images of different things at that time.
Right, right.
And then, the more fully awake I come, they fade away.
Yes, that's because mathematically, we're in the third dimension. The tetrahedrons that make up our molecules, we're in the third dimension. But we are actually a fourth or even fifth dimensional being living inside this body.
Right.
And the fourth dimension, you can actually see all sides at the same time. That's why it looks holographic to you.
Right. It's fascinating.
Wonderful. Well, keep up what you're doing, caller.
Thanks.
Thank you for calling. Is there an extraterrestrial activity going on the planet today?
That's a really good question. You know, I'm a scientist, so I have to go by hard evidence, and I myself have an open call. Anyone who finds a piece of metal, a bone, a symbol, a ball bearing, I don't care what it is, if it's from extraterrestrial sources, I want to see it. So far, I have not seen any hard evidence. However, I have seen 3 UFOs, and I've photographed them. Now, can I explain them? No. But I have not been able to actually go up and put my hands on it or take a sample. I have to say, if I apply Occam's razor to this, if I keep cutting away and cutting away at it, I don't come to an answer. I think it's impossible to discount hundreds of thousands of sightings every year. Something like 43 million Americans have actually seen a UFO. There's evidence of landings. There's angel hair, which is hard evidence left behind, albeit temporary. I think that we are getting very, very close to an event I affectionately call global first contact.
Mm. Wow. And how do you think that's going to take place?
Well, I think it's going to take place by an expedition that can be done to a remote place of the Earth, and it must be done with highest consciousness beings that can be assembled. And I don't mean, you know, just meditators. I mean scientists and filmographers and all kinds of professional observers. And they need to go to a remote place of the Earth, put themselves in position to be contacted. And then I think that 2 races, or maybe even more races than that, can come together and communicate on a broad scale. The introduction is about to be made.
Wow. Now this brings up a whole series of questions about the Hollow Earth and your expedition that I think you've canceled at this point, but are you going to do another one?
Well, we haven't canceled it. There's still a chance that we can get our August date in for 2008. As you know, this is the largest civilian expedition in history, and many people are calling it the greatest geological expedition in history. It is 100 scientists. It is about a $3.6 million expedition, and that's what it costs to charter the boat and get all the logistics done. Nobody makes any money off of this, and that's why it's never been done before. That and the area that needs to be surveyed has been covered by ice for over 200,000 years.
And where is
but
that?
It's on the other side of the North Pole from the magnetic North Pole. It's about 800 miles from Murmansk, Russia. There's only one ship on Earth that can make this trip. And the Northwest Passage opened in 2006. It refroze in 2007. And it's expected to refreeze even harder in 2008, but it's still barely passable by this ship. Once it gets to about 4 meters of ice, it's going to be sealed off forever. No one's ever going to see it.
Is that where Admiral Byrd went with his expedition?
It's possible. What Admiral Byrd did is he flew a 25-hour mission at less than 3,000 feet off the ice. That's why he's an aviation hero instead of a statistic
somewhere.
And he saw things on the ice that weren't supposed to be there. He said he saw flowing water, green foliage. He saw what he thought were mastodons. And now, from there, it gets kind of blurry because the only record that he made of this was oral. He did not write anything down. He did not leave anything behind. The diary that's floating around the planet is a fraud. And he didn't bring back any evidence. And he did not land. That is a misnomer as well. He flew over the North Pole in 26, over the South Pole in 29, and he was severely debriefed by the military. But he was also publicly excoriated for saying that he saw something other than ice below him.
By the military?
Well, by the general public, too. They did not want to hear about that at all. However, Edmund Halley in 1629 had a very elaborate hollow earth theory, and so have other scientists since him. And when you combine Newtonian physics, or Newtonian, say, planetology, along with Einsteinian physics, what you end up with is that planets form as hollow spheres, not as solid balls.
Is that because of the hypersphere? Is that spinning of this the sphere creates
yes.
like an hourglass in the center?
Well, I don't know about an hourglass, but a molten metal ball in the middle with a 800 or 900 mile thick crust around the outside and then an open air gap in between. The counter rotation between the two is what creates the magnetosphere.
Mm-hmm.
But plate tectonic theory is just a theory. The fact that the observation that we're filled with molten rock surrounding a solid metal core upon which float the crustal plates just doesn't hold water. It just doesn't hold water. By the time you compare it with the USGS data and the sort of MRI that we do of the Earth every time there's a major earthquake, this has been going on since the mid-90s, the pictures that we get show a hollow Earth. No doubt about it.
Wonderful. Well, I do hope you succeed at this. This is phenomenal.
Well, we'll succeed. It is expensive, and that's probably the biggest hurdle, is not selling all the information away so that we get the voyage done and come back and can't tell anybody anything. We have turned down a lot of money. We've turned down over $1 million because they wanted total control of the project.
Mm-hmm.
And we are trying to do this through private donations, through private corporations, and we will bring all of the information back to the public. We plan on making 18 90-minute documentaries and divulging everything. In fact, we're going to be streaming live from the ship during the whole 14-day expedition.
Wow. And what is the projected date? What are you aiming for?
The projected date is August of 2008. Now, we do have a fallback date of August of 2009, but we're almost positive that after 2009, the Northwest Passage will refreeze and will be inaccessible forever. This is not an expedition that's expected to succeed particularly. It is going to be rough conditions. The chances of success are slim. People that make this voyage might wish they never came because it's going to be tough. But we are looking for 100 of the best scientists with most open mind. We have filled 36 seats positively. We have 34 seats left for investors or for people who can afford to put up the funds to bring the scientists and all the equipment. And then we have some discretionary seats that we're using for filmmakers and writers and artists.
So if they go to your website, which is xsquareradio.com, they can get in touch with you. Is that right?
Yeah. It's actually x2, like the number 2, dash radio.com. Or they can just Google North Pole Expedition, and it'll come up. There's YouTubes out there. There's a 31-minute film out there that starts at Mount Shasta and goes to Tibet. Many people love that thing. If you like Discovery Channel, you're going to love that film.
Wonderful. I also know that you just returned from Egypt. You want to tell us what exciting things happened there?
Yeah, just got back from Egypt, shot about 90 minutes worth of high-def film, took a couple thousand shots, of course saw the normal tourist stuff, and then we went to two sites that predate the Egyptians all the way back to 9500 BC. One is called the Osirian, and the other one is called Abu Ghraib, which is near Abu Sir, outside of Cairo. Now, these two sites hold some very ancient, very high technology. One was a power station, and the other one was probably used to process gold.
Well, which is which?
Osirian was a power station. We estimate it was capable of generating about 4 megawatts of DC power. No distribution system, just local power. And Abu Ghraib is the most finely machined alabaster slab on Earth. It doesn't exist anywhere else. And it was probably used to ionically separate gold.
Wow. Well, I know the Osirian is, William Henry speaks about that a great deal. And
yes, William Henry went with us. He was doing his research on what he calls the Osiris device, And we were specifically researching the ionic water. We brought back samples. We're doing testing on that now. And the engineering of the granite slab.
How about the Great Pyramid? Did you get inside that?
Went inside the pyramids. They've been largely emasculated. They have moved what we call the dream chamber. That no bodies were ever buried in the pyramid. The Great Pyramid was not used for burial. It was used for ascension. It was used for seeing beyond the earth. But the chamber that's in the Great Pyramid, in the King's Chamber, has been moved from its focal point. The focal point's actually about 2 meters away from where that chamber is. It is amazing how that pyramid reflects magnetic energy. One of the proofs that we had is there were 30 people with us, and all of their hotel room keys were demagnetized.
Mm. Wow. Who built it, do you think? What's your take on were ETs involved in that, maybe?
Well, I don't really know. I think there was ancient technology applied there. There are granite slabs that weigh between 12 and 22 tons, elevated 300 feet up inside that. And the fact that we're talking about 1.5 million blocks that were put together in 2 years, and the precision of the Great Pyramid at Giza is far different than any of the other pyramids built. It actually matches the precision of pyramids built in South America, but it does not match the technology of the other pyramids built in Egypt. The one Great Pyramid was not local. It wasn't built by Egyptians. It was there a long time before Egyptus ever got to the Nile. But it is the same technology that was used to build the pyramids in South America.
Would you say that it's perhaps the same age as the Osirian?
I think pretty close. The Sphinx and the Great Pyramid we estimate to be about 13,000 years old. The Osirian about 9,500 BC or about 11,500 years. So about 2,000 years between them and about 300 miles.
Because the Osirian, when you look at the great granite slabs that are built there, they're incredible. They're, like you said,
the largest one was 80 tons, and it was moved 300 miles, and then it was elevated about 20 to 25 feet up and put on pins on top of columns. That is one solid piece of red granite quarried in Aswan, which is a long way from Abydos.
Wow. What's the sense you get about who is involved in helping? Do you feel that when I go back to the Revolutionary War, you speak about the Freemasons helped to win that war? What's that about?
Well, Freemasonry goes back to just before Hatshepsut in Egypt, but it was carried forward up through Scotland and England. My ancestors were deeply involved in it, going all the way back to the 14th century. And consequently, many people that lived in the British Isles were Freemasons, especially officers in the army. So as the British Army came to the United States to whip the colonial army, and I'm talking a ragtag, underarmed, underfunded army. They should have cleaned them up in about a year. What happened was they were painfully aware of a prophecy that the New Jerusalem would be formed in this continent. And they just simply weren't motivated to destroy the colonial army. They knew that this nation had to be formed. It had to be formed under certain conditions. George Washington, as well as many of the British officers, were Freemasons, and they would not fight against each other. They held each other as prisoners of war, but they would not defeat one another.
Wow.
And many of the symbols that are used in alchemy, which, as you know, is forming gold out of lead or value out of something baseless and worthless, those same talismans are all over the $1 bill, which is about worthless. But we put stock in it because of these ancient symbols and sacred geometry that's all over the $1 bill. That little piece of paper doesn't have anything backing it except the faith and credit of the United States. And the United States would not exist if it was not for the Solomon brothers, two Jewish brothers that lived in Israel. They financed this war, this colonial war. And because of that, George Washington made sure that their symbols, these ancient symbols, were placed on the $1 bill.
Well, some say that we really have never broken free from the British United Kingdom's power. So what's your take on that one?
Oh, I don't believe in the Illuminati. I don't believe there's any one shadow government that runs everything. I think there are a lot of little bureaucracies scratching for their own chips on a very immense table. But we, the people, are in charge of everything. We set the price of everything. We determine what's popular and what's unpopular. We determine the price of oil. We determine the value of the dollar. We are in charge of everything. All we have to do is realize that we are, and that's the end of that.
Fascinating. I knew that this was going to be an interesting and fast hour, and we are just about done with the show. And is there anything you would like to add? I like the note that you just ended with. Is there anything you'd like to add to that?
No, I think that's it. You had a great show. I love your mannerism, and I can't believe you've covered as much as we've covered in 1 hour, but we've actually only scratched the surface. We'll have to do this again.
Well, people will have to get your books to find out more.
They can go to Amazon.com or Barnes & Noble, or they can walk into their local bookstore and buy them. Or, you can get them at our website at any of the online stores at x2-radio.com.
Well, it has been an honor, Dr. Agnew. I would love to have you back, and we'll find out more maybe after you return from the expedition.
Oh, absolutely. I look forward to it.
Okay. And just to let my listeners know that you've been listening to Dr. Brooks Agnew on Carrie L's HeartLink. And we are going to have another show in 2 weeks with Mark Pinkham, who's written The Return of the Serpents of Wisdom. So I look forward to that. And this has been a delight. Thank you so much, Dr. Agnew. And thank you, listeners, and have a good evening.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.